This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Today, we are tearing apart a body of research that really, it fundamentally redefined how we see human nature.
And we aren't talking about philosophy here.
No, not at all. We're talking about the hardwired shortcuts of the human mind, and crucially, how those shortcuts make us systematically and predictably irrational.
It's probably one of the most important findings in all of modern behavioral science. I mean, for centuries, you look at philosophy, economics, law, the default view of humanity was this idea of homo economicus.
The rational man.
Exactly. The perfectly logical, self-interested agent who is always guided by logic and, you know, maximizing their utility.
But then decades of this really seminal psychological research, spearheaded by the Nobel Prize-winning work of Daniel Kahneman and his partner Amos Tversky, just completely shattered that image.
Completely.
Their research showed that our minds routinely use what they called heuristics.
Right. Mental shortcuts.
Which are super economical and fast, but they also produce these systematic, repeatable errors, which we now all know as biases.
And the initial impact was, well, it was staggering. Their 1974 paper sort of laid out the core principles, but it was their 1979 paper on prospect theory that transcended psychology altogether.
It really did.
It didn't just challenge rational choice theory. It gave us the first robust, descriptive model of decision-making that actually accounted for human error. And the result? Prospect theory is one of the most cited, most foundational articles in the entire history of economic thought.
So for this deep dive, we're really embarking on a mission. We need to walk away with a clear understanding of these foundational psychological frameworks.
And then map out the intense academic debate they ignited.
Yes, that battle between the pessimists and the optimists about the human mind. And then, critically, we need to bring it right up to the present day to examine the cutting-edge neuroscience that might explain why our brains are actually, well, designed to operate this way.
But let's start with that historical shift. Let's unpack the scientific mood of, what, the 1960s?
Yeah, let's dive in.
To really appreciate the impact that Kahneman and Tversky had, you have to understand the academic landscape they were walking into, the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It was characterized by a sort of a naive cognitive optimism.
Right. Psychologists really believed that human intelligence, you know, maybe it's limited by processing speed, but it was fundamentally logical at its core.
Fundamentally irrational.
And the source material really highlights how this optimistic view was kind of inadvertently supported by the very tools they were using. This idea called the tools as theories notion.
That is absolutely key. The psychological models of the time were so heavily influenced by the rise of computer science and, you know, the formal elegance of statistical inference.
So they started using these models as benchmarks.
Yes, they began to adopt these normative, rational benchmarks. Models based on classical logic, probability theory, Bayesian statistics. These became the measuring sticks for human thought.
So the measurement tool itself basically became the definition of what it meant to be rational.
Exactly. And when researchers compared actual human judgment to these ideal mathematical standards, the results were, well, they were devastating for that old optimistic view.
Every time human judgment deviated.
Anytime it deviated from these precise rational models, that gap wasn't seen as, say, adaptability or efficiency. It was immediately interpreted as a failure, a shortcoming, or a systematic insufficiency of the human mind.
It sounds like the moment you compare the human brain to a calculator, the brain is bound to lose. And so the entire research paradigm just shifted from exploring our competence to just documenting our flaws.
That's precisely what happened. The huge wave of empirical research that was triggered by K&T, and I mean the vast majority of it, it focused almost entirely on documenting these systematic errors, these cognitive illusions, fallacies, and delusions.
Even though the original theorists acknowledged that the shortcuts were useful.
Oh, absolutely. Kahneman and Tversky did acknowledge the functional and adaptive value of their mental shortcuts, just like, you know, how visual illusions in Gestalt psychology actually help us perceive depth adaptively. But the field's focus, it replaced that naively optimistic view with what many critics later called deflating pessimism.
And the narrative quickly became one that portrayed humans as, quote, nearly incapable of doing anything right.
It became a deficit-focused program. And even though heuristics are incredibly economical and usually really effective in most real-world scenarios, the scientific literature just ballooned with papers showing how they fail in these very specific controlled lab tests.
And that focus then fundamentally shaped how other fields, like economics and public policy, started to view the average citizen.
It did, which leads us right to the core mechanism here, this inevitable conflict between our desire for speed and our need for accuracy.
So let's define that. What is the formal definition of a heuristic?
The formal definition is that they simplify complex tasks. So think about tasks like assessing probabilities or predicting values or making complex inferences. Heuristics reduce them to much simpler judgmental operations.
And this simplification happens incredibly fast. This is what we now call type 1 or system 1 processing.
Correct. They are the fast, intuitive, automatic processes that often run implicitly, kind of in the background. And the defining feature that makes them so valuable is their efficiency.
Right. They don't demand our executive working memory resources.
You don't have to consciously think about them at all.
And that's critical because our working memory, I mean, the part of the brain we use for that deliberate, complex thought is extraordinarily limited.
It is severely constrained in its capacity.
Yeah.
And that is the domain of what we call type 2 or system 2 processing.
Mm-hmm.
The slow, conscious, controlled, and deliberate thinking.
Like trying to solve a complex algebra problem in your head.
Exactly. That requires system 2. And it demands a massive amount of cognitive energy. So relying on system 1 is, at its core, an energy-saving evolutionary adaptation.
So the biases, the errors, they occur when our rapid, energy-efficient system 1 spits out an answer.
And our slow, resource-heavy system 2 either fails to engage because, you know, we're tired or distracted.
Or it engages, but it just fails to successfully override that flawed intuitive response from system 1.
Essentially, yes. Mm. System 1 is our default setting, and it's optimized for speed. System 2 is the supervisor, but engaging that supervisor is costly. It's mentally taxing, and it's really prone to failure under pressure or cognitive load.
And that conflict right there between these two, system speed versus deliberate accuracy, that's the root cause of most of the biases that have been documented.
It is.
Okay, so let's unpack this conflict by looking at the specific mental shortcuts that really define this entire field of study. Let's start with maybe the most famous of the three core shortcuts from that 1974 paper, the representativeness heuristic.
The core mechanism of representativeness is it's deceptively simple. When you're faced with a question of probability, like what is the likelihood that object A belongs to class B, we evaluate it based on the degree to which A resembles B.
We judge by similarity.
Or how representative A is of the typical characteristics of B.
So this is basically the stereotyping heuristic. We're relying on stereotypical information instead of hard, factual, statistical data. And this shortcut leads directly to a whole host of systematic flaws.
The first, and certainly the most famous flaw, is base rate neglect. This is our insensitivity to the prior probability or frequency of outcomes. The classic scenario here is the engineer-lawyer problem.
Okay, walk us through that example in detail because I think it perfectly encapsulates this system one failure.
So subjects were given a set of personality descriptions of individuals. They were told these were sampled from a group of 100 people.
Okay.
In one condition, the sample was described as consisting of 70 engineers and 30 lawyers. So a 70% base rate for engineers.
Right.
In the second condition, they just flipped the base rate, 30 engineers and 70 lawyers. Then they were given a description, something like a person who is technically minded, detail-oriented, enjoys puzzles, a classic engineer stereotype.
Logically, if the description is totally ambiguous, the probability has to default to the base rate, right? If the sample is 70% engineers, the likelihood of any random person being an engineer is 70%.
Precisely. A rational calculation, which requires your system too, must incorporate that base rate. What the research found was that when people assessed the likelihood that this described person was an engineer, their estimated probability stayed nearly identical, say 90%, regardless of whether the pool consisted of 70% engineers or 70% lawyers.
So the system one brain just completely dismissed the highly relevant factual statistical information, the base rate, and relied solely on the vivid, immediately available stereotypical information, the description.
That is the failure. The description was highly representative of the engineer stereotype, and that representativeness heuristic just completely overrode the statistical anchor.
And you see this tendency everywhere in professional settings, like when venture capitalists judge a startup based on how much the founder looks like the stereotypical image of a successful tech founder, rather than on the actual market base rate for that specific sector.
It's a huge problem.
Mm.
Now, the second major bias that stems from this reliance on similarity is the conjunction fallacy. And this one, it violates the most basic law of probability.
It really does.
It's the illogical belief that the probability of two events occurring together, A and B, can somehow be higher than the probability of either one of those events happening alone.
Right. The probability of being a student and being tall has to be mathematically less than or equal to the probability of just being a student.
Of course. And this is where we get the famous Linda problem.
Right. So Linda is described as 31, single, bright, outspoken, and deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice.
And then subjects were asked to rank the probability of two statements. A, Linda is a bank teller. B, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement.
And the really counterintuitive finding is that most people judged B, the conjunction of two things, as more probable than A, the single event.
Yes, but why? Because the combined category feminist bank teller is so much more representative of the personality description they were given about Linda than the dull generic category bank teller by itself.
The rich narrative detail activates System 1's shortcut.
And it convinces us that the more specific narrative is more likely than the vague statistical reality. It's a perfect example of how our love for stories and stereotypes can just cloud our mathematical reasoning.
And finally, representativeness also explains our insensitivity to sample size. This is where we assume that these small subsets of data must reflect the characteristics of the large population they're drawn from.
This is demonstrated perfectly by the hospital problem. The question asks, which hospital would record more days where more than 60% of the babies born were boys? A large hospital delivering 45 babies a day, or a small hospital delivering 15 babies a day?
And if you ask people, they tend to believe the probability should be the same, or at least very, very similar in both hospitals. I think something like 53% of undergraduates chose the about the same option.
Which is deeply intuitive, but fundamentally wrong. This happens because the statistical figure, 60% boys, is equally representative of the expected population ratio, which is about 50% boys, regardless of the sample size.
So System 1 just treats a sample of 15 and a sample of 45 as equally valid representatives of the whole.
Right. But the law of large numbers dictates otherwise.
We should probably elaborate on that statistical truth for the listener.
Absolutely. The law of large numbers states that as your sample size increases, the actual average of that sample will converge more and more tightly toward the true population average.
But the flip side is crucial.
Yes. Conversely, small samples are inherently noisy and highly volatile. A small hospital delivering only 15 babies is much more likely, just due to random chance, to have a wildly abnormal day like 9 or 10 boys out of 15 than a large hospital delivering 45 babies is to have, say, 27 or more boys.
So outliers, these extreme results, they happen at a dramatically higher rate in the small hospital. The small hospital should statistically record far more of those abnormal days.
That's right. And the fact that we apply the same intuitive expectation to both sample sizes proves that the representativeness heuristic causes us to just ignore the sheer mathematics of variation. We're looking for the neat pattern, even where randomness is what's really in charge.
Let's move on to the second core shortcut, availability. This one feels like it might be the most powerful bias in our modern information age, driven by repetition and media coverage.
I think so. Availability is defined as estimating the probability or frequency of an event based on the ease with which examples can be retrieved from memory. It's a metacognitive cue.
We confuse how quickly something comes to mind with how frequent it actually is in the world.
Exactly. We assume that if we can effortlessly retrieve examples of something, that event must happen all the time.
Which leads to systematic errors based on a couple of factors. The first being retrieval ease.
Right. Events that are recent, vivid, emotional, or just heavily reported in the media will be much, much easier to retrieve from memory.
And this is why, you know, after a highly publicized plane crash, many people suddenly express these irrational fears of flying, even though the risk of driving their car has remained exponentially higher the entire time.
Exactly. The plane crash, because of its dramatic nature and the intense media coverage, is retrieved instantly and vividly. Conversely, the hundreds of thousands of daily, mundane car accidents are statistically frequent, but they're individually forgettable, and so they're not easily available.
And this leads to a massive misestimation of risk.
It also explains why political and marketing messaging relies so heavily on repetition.
Oh, absolutely.
Kahneman famously summarized this by saying, "A reliable way to make people believe is frequent repetition. If you hear a political slogan or an advertising jingle often enough, it becomes highly accessible in your memory. Its availability quickly converts into perceived validity and truth, regardless of any factual support."
The heuristic is basically being manipulated by external inputs.
It is. Now, the second factor here is imaginability. What if we don't have direct memories of an event?
Then we rely on how vividly we can imagine the event happening.
Right. If the difficulty or the danger of a risky task like climbing a mountain or embarking on a complex business venture can be vividly and dramatically portrayed, maybe focusing on the worst-case scenarios, the risk is made to appear exceedingly dangerous.
So the ease with which we can picture a disaster, a dramatic failure, distorts our calculation of its actual likelihood. It makes us overly cautious.
Precisely. And the reverse is true. If the dangers are abstract or difficult to conceive of or just don't come easily to mind, the risk is grossly underestimated.
Which might be why people sometimes fail to prepare adequately for these slowly accumulating risks, like climate change or a long-term financial collapse. They lack the immediate, vivid, and available examples of a sudden catastrophic failure.
Exactly. Now, the third classic heuristic, anchoring and adjustment, describes our deeply flawed approach to making numerical predictions.
So when we have to guess an uncertain quantity, our System 1 brain grabs onto some initial relevant or even totally irrelevant value, the anchor.
And then our System 2 attempts to adjust away from it. But the bias occurs because we almost always make an insufficient adjustment.
It's like dragging a heavy chain. That initial number has this gravitational pull on our final estimate, and we just never pull hard enough to break free from it.
That is the perfect analogy. And this insufficient adjustment is directly linked to overconfidence and miscalibration, which is a crucial professional failing for so many people.
How does that anchoring manifest as miscalibration?
Well, when experts or even novices are asked to provide confidence intervals for an uncertain quantity, say, predicting next quarter's sales range with 80% confidence, they typically produce intervals that are far, far too narrow.
They take their best guess, which is the anchor, and then they adjust insufficiently upward for the high end and insufficiently downward for the low end.
Right. So they believe there's only a 20% chance that the actual outcome will fall outside that range they've given.
When in reality, the outcome falls outside far more often.
Much more often. Studies consistently show that intervals given with 80% confidence often contain less than 50% of the subsequent realizations. This overly narrow interval reflects an unjustified certainty and really poor metacognition. They think they know more than they actually do.
And you mentioned that this insufficient adjustment is, at its heart, an energy-saving technique. If adjustment takes conscious effort, which is System 2, it makes sense that we just stop adjusting once we feel good enough, even if that answer is still biased by the anchor.
Absolutely. Stopping that costly process of adjustment prematurely is cognitively cheap. But this bias is pernicious because it affects everyone, from novices estimating world populations to expert financial analysts trying to predict market volatility.
And this is where anchoring gets really fascinating because it helps explain the regression fallacy. Let's go back to that flight instructor anecdote because it's such a brilliant trap.
It's the perfect illustration of confusing correlation with causation. So experienced flight instructors observed that when a cadet performed an exceptionally smooth landing, an outstanding performance, and they praised them for it, the very next landing was usually poorer.
And conversely, when a cadet performed a really rough landing, a poor performance, and they were given harsh criticism, the next landing was usually improved.
So the intuitive System 1 conclusion they drew was straightforward. Punishment works better than reward.
But that conclusion was completely unwarranted.
Completely. Yeah. The outcome is explained entirely by a statistical concept, regression toward the mean.
Yeah.
Any extraordinary performance, good or bad, is statistically likely to be followed by a more average performance, just by chance.
So the good student was highly likely to have a slightly worse landing, regardless of whether they got praise or not.
And the poor student was highly likely to improve, regardless of the criticism. The mind anchors on the perceived cause, the critique or the praise, and it fails to adjust for the massive statistical fact that excellence and failure are often temporary deviations that just naturally drift back to the average performance level.
We anchor on the immediately preceding action, our own critique, and we assume it caused the regression. And that leads to this highly counterintuitive lesson that we are statistically rewarded for punishing others and punished for rewarding them.
Exactly. The anchoring on our own intervention prevents us from seeing the statistical noise that's inherent in the entire process.
Okay, so far we've focused on these heuristics of judgment, how we assess probability. But Kahneman and Tversky's next big move was to challenge the very heart of economics, decision-making under risk. And this resulted in prospect theory.
And this is where their work becomes truly revolutionary. For decades, the normative standard for rationality was something called expected utility theory, or EUT. EUT posited that rational agents assess the probability of different outcomes, they multiply those probabilities by the value or utility of the outcomes, and then they choose the option that maximizes their final expected wealth.
EUT was really the bedrock of rational economics. It defined what it meant to be a rational actor. So how did prospect theory go about attacking it?
Prospect theory was developed as a descriptive model of how people actually behave, arguing that our individual choices systematically violate the core tenets of EUT. The fundamental difference lies in reference dependence.
EUT assumed that value was based on your absolute final wealth, the total amount of money in your bank account at the end of the day.
Right. But K&T argued that humans don't calculate absolute wealth. We calculate change.
We feel change.
Exactly. Value is defined in terms of deviations from a reference point, meaning perceived gains or losses. If you win $100, the value you derive is based on the gain of $100 relative to your current reference point, not the difference between your final wealth of, say, $100,100 and your initial wealth of $100,000. This shift in perspective completely reframed the whole calculation.
And this framework then explains one of the most powerful and persistent human behaviors, loss aversion. The psychological pain of a loss is something like 2 to 2.5 times greater than the pleasure of an equivalent gain.
We can visualize this difference with what's called the prospect theory value function. It's shaped like an S-curve, and it's centered at the reference point. The curve for gains is relatively shallow and concave, which means winning $200 isn't twice as valuable as winning $100, but the curve for losses is significantly steeper and convex.
Meaning the pain of losing $100 is far more potent than the pleasure of gaining $100.
Far more. It shows why we fight so much harder to prevent losses than we do to secure gains.
And this reference dependence also explains the famous reflection effect on our risk preferences.
This is the dual nature of human risk-taking. In the domain of gains, when you're faced with a risky choice, agents are overwhelmingly risk-averse. They prefer a sure, smaller payoff over a gamble that actually has a higher expected value.
Like preferring a certain $450 over a 50% chance of winning $1,000, you lock in the sure gain.
But when choices are framed in the domain of losses, that behavior completely flips.
It just reverses.
Agents become risk-seeking. They prefer taking a gamble, even if that gamble has a worse expected outcome, in the hope of avoiding a sure loss. This explains why people will hold on to a failing stock for way too long, preferring a 50% chance of losing $1,100 over a 100% chance of losing $500.
They're gambling to get back to that reference point of zero loss.
Exactly. And this is a direct violation of EUT, which assumes that our risk preferences should be consistent. This sensitivity to context leads directly to framing effects.
And framing effects demonstrate that the way a logically equivalent choice problem is presented actually dictates the choice we make. Rational agents should be indifferent to how a problem is phrased. Humans are not.
Not at all. The classic public health example is critical here.
Walk us through it.
Okay, so consider a choice presented to the public about a disease that's expected to kill 600 people. Program A guarantees that 200 people will be saved. That's a gain frame. Program B gives a 1/3 probability that all 600 people will be saved and a 2/3 probability that no people will be saved.
And in that case, most people choose program A. They are risk-averse for gains.
They lock it in. But if the same choice is presented in a loss frame, program C results in 400 people dying. That's a sure loss. Program D gives a 1/3 probability that nobody will die and a 2/3 probability that 600 people will die.
And programs A and C are mathematically identical. So are B and D.
They are. Yet when framed as losses, most people choose D. They become risk-seeking to avoid the sure loss of 400 deaths. The frame alone shifts us from risk aversion to risk seeking.
And this realization has enormous political and social ramifications.
Oh, absolutely. Political leaders and policymakers use this constantly. If you phrase an economic initiative as ensuring 90% employment, that's a gain frame. It encourages the public to remain risk averse and support the status quo.
But if you frame the exact same policy as 10% unemployment,
that's a loss frame. And it pushes people into risk-seeking behavior, demanding radical, disruptive policy changes to recover that perceived loss. It is an incredibly powerful tool for public manipulation.
Kahneman's later work then expanded beyond just choice to differentiate how we actually experience pleasure and pain versus how we remember it. And this added a really fascinating layer of complexity to the human condition.
He realized that utility wasn't a single monolithic concept. He defined three types. Experienced utility, which is the momentary feeling of pleasure or pain during an event.
What you feel in the moment.
Right. Then there's decision utility, which is the utility we infer from the choices people make. And finally, remembered utility, which is our overall valuation of a past experience.
And the big revelation here is that our remembered utility is the best predictor of our subsequent decision utility. We choose what to do next based on our memory of the event, which, it turns out, is often deeply flawed.
The memory is systematically inaccurate because of the peak end rule. Our overall evaluation of a past experience is determined almost entirely by just two brief moments: how the experience felt at its peak intensity, good or bad, and how it felt right at its end.
You're telling me that the duration of the episode, the entire middle part of the experience, has virtually no effect on how we remember it? I mean, that just defies common sense.
Rationally, it should matter. The total cumulative pain or pleasure should be what counts. But psychologically, it just doesn't. And the source material uses the now famous colonoscopy example.
Okay.
Patients undergoing a painful procedure had the procedure extended by 3 minutes. But crucially, those three added minutes were of only moderate discomfort.
So objectively, they experienced more total cumulative pain because the procedure lasted longer.
Correct. But because the procedure ended less painfully, with moderate discomfort rather than that high peak pain, the patient's remembered evaluation of the overall experience was significantly improved.
Wow.
They were more likely to return for subsequent procedures because they remembered it less negatively. Their memory betrayed their true experience.
That is astonishing. It really shows how our experiencing self and our remembering self are just fundamentally disconnected.
And this error in what's called affective forecasting, or estimating our future happiness, is compounded by the focusing illusion. This is when people exaggerate the importance of one specific factor while just overlooking the myriad of other factors that influence their general state of being.
And this gives us Kahneman's brilliant, simple dictum: nothing in life is as important as you think it is when you are thinking about it.
Yes. If you focus on buying a new, flashy car, your affective forecasting will tell you that this car will make you supremely happy because you're focusing on that one new, exciting future.
And you ignore all the daily realities.
You ignore the traffic, the cost of insurance, the need for maintenance, and the simple fact that you will quickly habituate to the novelty. That single factor is just inflated beyond all reasonable measure.
And this disconnection between experienced reality, our flawed memories, and rational choice has had the greatest economic impact in the field of behavioral finance.
Oh, yes. Behavioral finance argues that the systematic biases inherent in human decision-making and forecasting really invalidate the long-held classical assumption of the efficient market hypothesis, or EMH.
The EMH, which dictates that asset prices fully reflect all available information because all investors are perfectly rational.
But if investors are relying on availability and representativeness and flawed memory, the market cannot possibly be perfectly efficient.
It can't be.
Psychological factors like herd behavior, fear, overconfidence, they introduce predictable anomalies into the market. For instance, the errors in remembered utility, like focusing only on the peak success of a market bubble and forgetting the painful losses endured right before, that can fuel subsequent irrational investment decisions.
So let's talk about some of the specific biases that stem from these heuristics when money is on the line. We touched on the endowment effect earlier.
The endowment effect is a classic manifestation of loss aversion. People irrationally demand much more to give up an object they already possess than they would be willing to pay to acquire it in the first place.
Which is highly irrational from a normative perspective.
But it's perfectly consistent with prospect theory. Giving up something you own feels like a loss, which registers with a much higher emotional weight than the pleasure of an equivalent gain, which is acquiring it.
And another powerful one is hindsight bias, which is so critical for our own self-reflection.
Hindsight bias means that once an event has occurred, a stock tanked, or a house doubled in value, we erroneously perceive that past event as having been inevitable, or at least much more predictable than it actually was before it happened.
We tell ourselves, I knew that was going to happen all along.
And this is deeply damaging because it prevents us from accurately assessing the risk that was inherent in our past decisions. It means we fail to learn from our mistakes, and we continue to take excessive risks based on this illusion of past predictability.
And finally, we see the familiarity bias.
Right. Investors prefer stocks of companies they recognize or use, or domestic companies, even when objective, factual data suggests that geographically distant or unfamiliar stocks offer better risk-adjusted returns.
And this is just availability at play. Familiar names are easily retrieved from memory, so they feel safer, regardless of the underlying financial facts.
Exactly.
So the Heuristics and Biases program fundamentally shifted psychological and economic theory, but its findings immediately ignited this really passionate academic debate. And the most forceful critique came from Gerd Jigarenzer and his colleagues.
Jigarenzer argued that the K&T program was overly pessimistic and, crucially, it was methodologically flawed. The debate really boils down to whether heuristics are generalized, flawed shortcuts, or if they are highly optimized, rational tools designed for specific environments.
So what was Jigarenzer's central theoretical problem with the classic heuristics like representativeness?
It was the vagueness problem. Jigarenzer argued that the labels themselves, availability, representativeness, were just too vague. He said they functioned merely as theory surrogates.
Meaning they could explain almost any outcome after the fact.
Right, but they lacked the necessary scientific precision. They didn't have clearly defined falsifiable process models or defined antecedent conditions. When does the heuristic kick in? The K&T framework often didn't specify.
He wanted actual testable algorithms, not just these big umbrella terms for psychological tendencies.
Exactly. And his second major critique focused on external validity. He argued that the celebrated biases were often just cognitive illusions created by the experimental designs themselves.
Specifically, using these single event probability formats, like the chance of Linda being a bank teller.
Yes. He argued that the human mind is adapted for reasoning about frequencies in the natural world, not these abstract probabilities in a lab.
So he posited that if the researchers had just asked, out of 100 people who are like Linda, how many are bank tellers and also feminists, the illusion would just disappear.
He claimed that using frequency formats aligns with the mind's natural evolutionary state, and therefore the so-called biases were just artifacts of the experimental method, not inherent flaws in human cognition.
But Jigarenzer wasn't just being destructive. He offered an optimistic countermodel, ecological rationality.
Right. He proposed this metaphor of an adaptive toolbox that contains what he called fast and frugal heuristics, or FFH. And this view shifts the focus from optimizing a rational output, which is the System 2 goal, to optimizing resource efficiency, the System 1 goal.
So how are these FFH different from Kahneman and Tversky's more generalized heuristics?
They are defined by clearly spelled out step-by-step algorithms. They are models of bounded rationality, a concept that was pioneered by Herbert Simon, which accepts that the mind is limited but asserts that these very limitations can make us smart in specific environments.
Can you give us an example of a specific FFH algorithm?
The most famous is the take the best heuristic. Imagine you're trying to guess which of two cities, A or B, is larger, but you only have limited information. Take the best doesn't weigh a bunch of different cues. Instead, it uses a highly efficient single cue approach.
Okay, so what are the steps?
First, the search rule.
Yeah.
Search through cues like, does it have a major league sports team or does it have university? In order of their proven predictive validity.
Then what?
Then the stopping rule. You stop searching the moment you find a single cue that discriminates between the two options. And finally, the decision rule.
Mm-hmm.
You choose the city favored by that one cue.
So it's a lexicographic strategy. It relies on the very first piece of information that makes a difference, and then it just ignores all subsequent information, no matter how relevant it might seem.
It saves a massive amount of processing effort. And Jigarenzer showed that in certain environments where information is costly or it's missing or it's redundant, take the best often performs just as well as, and sometimes even better than, complex resource-intensive normative models like multiple regression.
So it demonstrates that relying on less information can actually be more rational under real-world constraints.
Exactly.
This really feels like a true battle of worldviews. Pessimism versus optimism. Where does the academic consensus land now?
Well, the consensus acknowledges the critical value of Jigarenzer's work on ecological rationality. But his claims about completely eliminating biases prove to be overstated.
For example, the claim that our human intuition actually follows those specific FFH algorithms.
That evidence remains pretty scarce. Furthermore, subsequent experimental work showed that while framing problems in frequency format sometimes reduces the instance of biases, it does not always make the cognitive illusions disappear entirely.
So the conjunction fallacy still showed up.
It did, which suggests the bias runs deeper than just the format presentation.
So the argument that biases are purely cognitive illusions created by the lab design may have been a bit too extreme. And this forced researchers to look at biases not as mere failures, but perhaps as intelligent adaptations that were just being measured by the wrong ruler.
Exactly. The debate suggests that many of these perceived biases may, in fact, be reasonable assumptions about the task setting. Our cognitive systems make statistical inferences that hold true in the noisy, uncertain environments we evolved in. But these same inferences are judged as erroneous when they're tested in a sterile, perfectly defined lab setting.
And the source material mentions this idea that content-blind normative models are often inappropriate benchmarks, a normative mismatch.
This is a really powerful point. If the KNT program judges human decision-making against the ideal of an omniscient Bayesian calculator, then of course humans fail. But if you judge the mind against its evolutionary purpose, which is survival and efficient resource management in an uncertain world, then heuristics look brilliant.
And this reframes that insensitivity to sample size we discussed earlier. Instead of being a bias, it could be interpreted as a sensible adaptation.
It suggests that the belief in the law of small numbers might not be an error at all, but rather an astonishingly fine-tuned sensitivity to the statistics of finite samples.
How so?
In the real world, small groups often are representative of their larger community in meaningful sociological ways. Our intuition is only deemed erroneous when it's evaluated against the inappropriate normative standard of an infinite population model. This shift moves the focus from human incompetence to environmental adaptation.
So the tension between Kahneman's pessimistic view and Gigerenzer's optimistic view has really driven decades of research. But now we can pivot to a truly modern unifying perspective that moves beyond computation or environment to look at the brain itself. The neural network framework.
Yes, and it argues that biases are not just cognitive flaws, but fundamental design features of our biology.
So this approach ditches that old computer metaphor, the idea that the brain is just a machine running algorithms like software.
Instead, it posits that the brain is wetware. And these systematic biases arise from intrinsic structural mechanisms that are inherent to biological neural networks mechanisms that were originally optimized for really simple biological, perceptual, and motor functions.
So our psychological biases are rooted in the physical reality of how our neurons connect and transmit information. They are the hardwired defaults of the brain's physical structure.
That's right. Our tendency to default to type 1 processing is fundamentally driven by four basic principles that are inherent to the design and operation of biological neural networks.
Okay, let's break down these four fundamental biological principles that create our biases. First up, association.
Association is the most basic binding principle of all neural activity. The brain's main job is to connect inputs. It binds information together, even if that information is logically unrelated or irrelevant in a strict sense. This structural necessity for linkage forms the basis for heuristic thinking, allowing us to jump rapidly from QA to conclusion B.
Second, compatibility. This sounds like the biological underpinning of our preference for consistency.
That's exactly right. The compatibility principle means the brain prioritizes, integrates, and seeks out information that is compatible and consistent with its current state, meaning our existing knowledge, opinions, and expectations. It is just energetically cheaper to integrate confirming information than it is to process dissonant information.
So biologically, we are designed to stick to our existing neural pathways.
Which perfectly explains why we struggle with new ideas or dissonant facts. This principle structurally underpins the confirmation bias seeking information that confirms what we already believe, and also the conservatism bias and status quo bias, where we prefer the existing state because it aligns with our current neural integrity.
The third principle, retainment, is maybe the most difficult to grasp, but also the most profound. It's the difference between deleting a file on a computer and erasing a path in the biological brain.
Yes. When a computer deletes a file, the memory space is marked as available, but the structure remains intact. The biological brain is different. Once information is perceived and processed, it is structurally encoded in the wetware via synaptic changes.
The neurons that fire together wire together in principle.
Exactly, following Hebbian principles. And you cannot simply ignore or delete this structural encoding.
The information is physically embedded.
And because it's embedded, it always exerts a structural pull. This inherent retention is the biological mechanism for two huge biases. First, the anchoring bias. The initial value, the anchor, is the first piece of information that gets structurally encoded. And because it cannot be physically disregarded, all subsequent adjustments must drag against that initial fixed wiring. The anchor literally bends the neural path.
And this structural encoding also provides a step-by-step explanation for the pernicious hindsight bias.
This is a beautiful explanation. When we experience an outcome, say a specific stock price movement, That new knowledge is associatively processed in memory alongside the existing circuits that encoded the decision situation, so the market data, the news at the time. The new outcome knowledge physically modifies the original memory circuit.
So the brain doesn't store the original decision-making process and the new outcome separately, it just blends them together.
It blends them. The original, objective representation of the situation, the uncertainty, the lack of predictability, it becomes inaccessible because it has been structurally altered by the certainty of the outcome. We genuinely structurally believe we knew it all along because our memory circuits have been rewritten to integrate the outcome, making the event feel retrospectively inevitable.
And how does retainment explain the endowment effect?
The possession of an item or even concept is sustained by constant reinforcing neural encoding. The longer you own something, the more robust its representation is in your wetware. The loss of that item is perceived as a greater disruption to the integrity of the associated neural circuitry, a biological cost, than the mere idea of not acquiring it in the first place.
That disruption cost is loss aversion at a biological level.
It is. The fourth and final principle is focus neglect. This principle simply states that the brain is forced by resource constraints to focus on dominant, activated information while systematically neglecting other relevant information that is not directly available or activated. If a piece of information is activated, it monopolizes processing resources. If it's not activated, it's effectively ignored.
Which links directly back to the very first heuristics we discussed, like availability. We focus on the things that easily pop up, the dominant information, and we neglect the hard-to-retrieve data.
It creates a cognitive echo chamber where the most active information becomes the only information, and that leads to massive data neglect in our decision models.
What's truly remarkable here is that this hardwired biological view found profound validation in a completely non-biological realm, artificial intelligence.
Yes.
The most sophisticated large language models, LLMs, are now showing that they exhibit the core features of human biases, particularly prospect theory.
This 2025 finding is huge. LLMs are trained on these massive data sets of human language and interaction, which means they're essentially modeling the world through the lens of human narrative and decision making.
And the fact that prospect theory, which was developed specifically for flawed human psychology, emerges in these artificial neural networks suggests that these biases are embedded in the very structure of information itself.
It does. Practically, the models show both risk aversion for gains and risk seeking for losses. If you present it with a monetary choice problem, the model's output will choose the sure gain over the equivalent gamble and the gamble over the sure loss, just like a human would.
Which confirms that the models aren't calculating a perfect, rational, expected utility?
No, they're calculating the human expectation of utility.
This means the framing effect is deeply linguistic. It's embedded within the structure of human communication.
Exactly. The frame, the difference between 90% survival and 10% mortality, is apprehended by the model because the language itself carries the human cognitive bias. Furthermore, the researchers found that context was critical. The magnitude of the framing effect was much larger in scenarios involving, say, military strategy or high-stakes risk than in mundane civilian scenarios.
So the LLMs reflect our own tendency to rely on System 1 thinking more heavily when we perceive stress or high stakes or emotional weight. That validates that these biases are domain-specific and heavily tied to narrative structure.
It's a powerful confirmation. It shows that whether the system is biological wetware or a massive digital neural network, when it's constrained by modeling the complex, biased nature of human language, the resulting decision patterns are predictably irrational.
So we've really taken a journey today.
We have. We've spanned half a century of behavioral science, moving from that initial pessimistic view of Kahneman and Tversky, who showed us our flaws,
through the optimistic challenge of Jijirenzer, who reframed those shortcuts as adaptive efficiency.
And finally, to the modern neural framework, which suggests these biases are the inescapable hardwired defaults of our very design.
And the key synthesis, though, is understanding the mechanism. We've moved away from just calling people irrational. We now understand the biological and computational drivers, from the demands of retainment in our neurons to the single-cue search of an FFH algorithm that govern why human thought operates the way it does.
And this leads to the critical question of debiasing. Given the pervasive structural nature of these biases, that they are the brain's natural defaults, it should come as no surprise that simple warnings are largely ineffective.
Right. Telling someone they're exhibiting hindsight bias is like telling them to ignore an itch. The biological impulse is still there.
It remains. If warnings don't work, the research recommends a substantial investment in explicit in-depth training. It's not enough to just define the bias.
You have to be taught the specific causes and consequences.
And the explicit strategies to counter it. This involves a System 2 intervention. Training people to systematically argue against their own intuitive answer, to explicitly consider the opposite bounds of a confidence interval, or to imagine reasons why their initial answer might be fundamentally wrong.
You have to build a trained System 2 override mechanism that's powerful enough to conquer the energetic efficiency of System 1.
That's the challenge.
So what does this massive body of work mean for you, the individual decision maker? We've established that the cognitive processes of association and retainment are fundamental to biological neural networks. Your memories are not objective storage units. They are constantly being modified by new outcomes. That's the very mechanism of hindsight bias.
So if the brain is fundamentally structured to rewrite the past in light of the present, and if we are biologically driven to believe our memories are accurate and our past choices were predictable, then how can you ever truly trust your objective recall of how and why you made a decision in the past, or assess risk accurately based on that flawed recollection?
Perhaps the greatest challenge presented by the heuristics and biases research isn't changing our future decisions, but rather accepting the radical idea that we must constantly question and potentially revise the stories we tell ourselves about our past ones. Something for you to mull over until our next deep dive.